of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Ross, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this virtual Zoom session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, February 5th, 2025. We have two matters on our oral calendar this morning. The first matter I will call is 823-0453, State of Minnesota versus Eric James Reinbold. Counsel, this hearing is being recorded, but only an audio version will appear later on our website, probably later today. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. At the start of your principal arguments, if each of you could please state your name and a party you represent for the record, we'd appreciate it. And then, like you're doing, of course, keep yourself on mute when you're not presenting. With that, counsel for appellant, we are ready for you.
Well, good morning on this very cold day. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Christopher Kadam. I represent the appellant, Eric Reinbold, in this matter. And we're before the court to challenge kind of in high point two issues, the district court's denial of my client's petition for post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing, and then also to reverse the imposition of an aggravated sentence. With regard to the post-conviction relief, the question before this court is not whether appellant's trial counsel provided ineffective assistance of counsel. That is where the state wants to draw this court's attention, but that is a misplaced argument at this stage. Because it was only a petition at this stage, the question is before this court is properly whether the district court abused its discretion when it denied him a hearing. And whether it abuses its discretion in the manner in which it conducted its review of the petition and the evidence. I do want to raise
Those issues are interwoven, aren't they?
Well, I think at a very low level, they're interwoven. I mean, the issue raised in the petition is ineffective assistance of counsel in part. But we don't need to satisfy the Strickland test at this stage of the proceeding. We don't have to prove ineffective assistance of counsel at this stage of the proceeding. What we need to look at is whether or not the district court, in evaluating the petition and the evidence, properly applied the correct standards to doing so, and whether it properly denied a hearing. And it's our position, obviously, that it did not. I would note in my filings and the state's filing, we indicate that the standard for review of this issue is abuse of discretion, and I do not think that's accurate. I think there may be some conflict in the law on this. If the court looks at Martin v. State, it indicates that factual findings are reviewed for abuse of discretion, but legal conclusions are reviewed de novo. And then the state, and I think originally I, were looking at Zielinski, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court case of 2024 that seems to suggest the entire thing is reviewed for abuse of discretion. I draw that issue to the court's attention. I think it's an important one here that needs to be resolved. I believe there's a serious lack of harmony in the procedures for post-conviction relief petitions in general that we asked the court also to address, we raised in our memorandum, and that is whether the state is even allowed to respond with contrary evidence found outside the trial.
Can I pause you for a minute? How does your view of the standard of review, or how does Brustell v. State bear upon your view of the standard of review on this question?
I can't speak to that specific case on the standard of review. Again, there's a lot of, in my opinion, there's some disharmony in how the courts have reconciled it. I will say on a higher level review of what the courts are doing, I think part of the problem is it's difficult to tell whether or not the courts are looking at a first petition for post-conviction relief as opposed to looking at a subsequent petition. A lot of the cases are subsequent petitions. And of course, the statutes provide that a summary that the court may summarily dismiss a subsequent petition. And I believe that type of disposition would be reviewed for abuse of discretion, whereas a first petition.
Doesn't this case mirror Brustell in that regard as to the timing of the petitions and the circumstances?
It may, and again, there's disharmony in Burstell and Martin and Ferguson, and then Zelensky with regard to whether or not it would be just all abuse of discretion, or whether or not it would be de novo for the legal conclusions.
Well, it seems that Burstell, in a case that mirrors ours procedurally, I think, the court said in order for our court to overturn the post-conviction court's decision, that was the decision to reject the petition for post-conviction relief on ineffective assistance of counsel on the same issues that you're raising, without an evidentiary hearing, we would have to conclude that the post-conviction court abused its discretion in finding no basis for an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
I don't disagree with that the case may hold that. I question whether or not that is an accurate holding given some of the other case law, and I find disharmony among those cases with regard to that standard of review.
Well, in any event, however the court characterizes standard of review, the court went on to say that, well, went on to hold that the district court did not inappropriately refused to allow an evidentiary hearing because there was no direct act, no any directly applicable evidence, or even the promise of any such evidence that the defendant was so likely insane under the M'Naughten rule at the time of the killing that his trial counsel's decision not to pursue a Rule 20 argument constitutes ineffective assistance of counsel. So, however we describe the standard of review, it seems as if there is an obligation on your part to identify for your client the directly applicable evidence presented to the district court, or the promise of directly applicable evidence that it was so likely that your client was insane under the M'Naughten rule at the time of the killing. So under that standard, what was the evidence that was presented, that was identified in the petition, that would support that basis for reversing?
It was the long history that was available to trial counsel of serious mental health issues and the medical records that accompanied those, along with the report of Dr. Reitman, that indicated that he certainly should have been assessed for Rule 2002 at the time of this matter. The question at this stage is whether or not a retroactive analysis could be done on the facts before the court. And I will acknowledge that is probably one of the weaker points in our
Well, can you quote for us the language in these reports that you're referring to that demonstrate that at the time of the killing, your client was likely insane under the M'Naughten rule? What is the best evidence supporting that?
Well, I think I would draw the court's attention to Dr. Reitman's report as to his mental health history that was ongoing and consistent. And
Right.
so
What
I
was the statement in Dr. Reitman's report that would demonstrate for us, or that should have demonstrated to the district court, that your client was likely insane under the M'Naughten rule at the time of the killing?
would point the court's attention to his specific statement that he should have been evaluated for a 2002
Well, that's a conclusory assertion by Dr. Reitman. I want to know what is the evidence that he was so likely insane at the time of the killing that would have alerted the lawyer that this has to be done, that
Well,
we
this lawyer was involved with this particular, with the appellant for a long period of time and had access to all those psychological records in the prior files as we briefed. And so he was aware of that in
No, I
addition to the
understand that.
fact.
I guess I'm just trying to focus you specifically on any language in those prior reports that would indicate to counsel so clearly that a Rule 20 proceeding should occur. That is, that the M'Naughten rule could be met if we pursue this. What is the evidence of that?
If I could just have a moment to try and grab that
And
language.
what I think would be helpful is there, if there had been some language in any of these reports by a competent expert that your client, lacked the capacity to understand right from wrong, or knew what he was doing was wrong, or what didn't know what he was doing was wrong, didn't know the nature of his conduct.
Well,
Was
I think the problem
it
is we're looking at early reports of a pretty significant psychosis, and trying to discern what was happening in the future after those reports. The question is really whether or not, in reviewing those reports, a competent attorney, in addition to meeting with this appellant, in addition to the facts of this case, would have understood or believed that there was a mental health issue. I don't believe we as practitioners are competent to decide whether our clients are Rule 2001 or 2002. I think that is a question that is better left for an expert if we have the
Exactly. And so
trappings of
that's
those
what I'm looking
issues.
for. I think that's what Justice Anderson was referring to in Broustel, that there needed to be something like that, something of an expert report that would support the idea. The court said there is no expert testimony in the record regarding either his mental state at the time he killed McIntyre or at the time he pleaded guilty. And the court went on to say the nature of the evidence that it was referring to was evidence that it was so likely insane under the M'Naughten rule at the time of the killing that would demonstrate that trial counsel's effectiveness was the trial counsel's performance was ineffective. And so maybe if you could, is there something you can quote that is the most compelling that would have informed counsel of the need for a Rule 20 strategy?
I guess I can't put anything off the top of my head, Your Honor. As I stated, kind of when we went down this road, I would concede that this is probably the weaker of the arguments that we have made in our filings. I think it certainly highlights a pattern of ineffectiveness by this attorney, and I can't offer anything into the record at this time in terms of my experience with appellant and what I've observed. But I can certainly say that based on the facts and the circumstances of this case, if appellant was responsible for this murder, it raises the question or the specter of a 2002 issue here, in addition to the clear psychological history that the defendant had. I don't believe that the defendant, in his historical records, needs to demonstrate 2002 in the past in order for him to be 2002 at the time of this situation. That would be an unfair standard, that he had already been determined to be 2002 or met the circumstances or requirements of 2002 in order for you to be on notice that there you may now have it. In other words, psychological
I'm not
difficulties tend to
suggesting
get
that.
worse with time.
I'm not suggesting that. I was just trying to parallel this case with what the Supreme Court in Broustel indicated was necessary. Can I ask you one more question, then I'll shut up because I know you've other issues you want to raise. Isn't your I'm trying to get a sense, aren't your two primary ineffective assistance of counsel theories inconsistent with each other? On the one hand, that he committed the offense, but he was mentally ill when he did it, and so he's not guilty by reason of mental illness. On the other, that he didn't commit the offense and that he fled innocently.
I think they are inconsistent. I mean, factually they are inconsistent, but that's the very way the 2002 defense is laid out within the statutes and the law, right? We do bifurcated trials. You can assert not guilty for phase one, and then phase two is when you deal with not guilty by reason of mental illness. Minnesota has long been an alternative pleading state where you can plead alternative theories, and I don't think their inconsistency in any way prohibits proceeding in that manner. And that certainly is what the state argued, and I think ineffectively and incorrectly at the district court level. And I think at some level the district court bought into that notion that you can't have it both ways, but you certainly can, and the rule is designed to have it both ways. And so the state first has to prove not guilty or guilt, and then if they find guilt, you go to phase two, and that's when you introduce evidence of the psychological issues. And so typically the jury would be shielded from that in the first phase of the trial. And so the inconsistency is there, but it's not legally significant. Does
Counsel,
that answer?
you indicated that you had a strong argument for post-conviction hearing, I believe, that one that you felt was stronger than the mental illness defense. Would you
Yeah.
mention that in
Yeah,
your
they Thank
opinion?
you. Yeah, I certainly think the alternative perpetrator theory in this case is a very, very strong one. And I think probably most compellingly for the purposes of appeal is the way the district court handled that analysis. And again, going back to where I left off, the idea that the state had submitted evidence contrary to the petition, I don't believe was allowed, and I don't think it's appropriate under the statutes for the court to have received and considered that evidence, because under the statutes, first, the threshold is incredibly low, and it provides that the petitioner should provide all arguments and provide facts to support its petition, but it does not require the inclusion of all facts, and then it provides that basically the light or the reviewing court should view it in the light most favorable to the petition. That's the hall pass for the petitioner to bring evidence before the court. The state doesn't have a similar statute or law that allows them to bring their evidence in, and I think for good reason, because it doesn't.
Can I jump in? What was the most persuasive, non-speculative evidence that of an alternative perpetrator?
Well, all the evidence with regard to Matthew Lenhart and the children was non-speculative. That was all evidence actually in the record. through the testimony, there was some supplementation of that of additional evidence that we drew out of text messages and things like that, but none of that was speculative. That was all actual evidence, actual statements, actual inconsistencies that were drawn out. I see my time's up.
Thank you for paying attention to that, counsel. I appreciate it. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well.
Thank you.
Thanks. And counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. Counsel, good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. Regarding the standard of review, I don't think this is really a pressing detail. Reviewed for an abuse of discretion, and as the Supreme Court said in Zielinski, you know, you review the legal determinations de novo, and you review factual findings under the clearly erroneous standard. I think that's pretty straightforward abuse of discretion analysis. And with respect to an evidentiary hearing, whether one should have been granted, as I note in my brief, an evidentiary hearing affords the post-conviction court an opportunity to evaluate a witness's credibility. I don't know what witness credibility we needed, that the post-conviction court needed to evaluate here. You can dismiss one if the petition fails to allege facts that, if proven, would entitle the petitioner to relief. And just going in order, the mental health claim, defendants are presumed sane. I think that may be the stumbling block that appellant overlooks here. Defendants are presumed to be sane. If you want to present a mental illness defense, you have to make a prima facie showing of it. And the language is very clear. Yet, as I point out, the expert's affidavit pointedly avoids using any of that language. He may be suffering from a serious mood disorder, as well as a possibility of a thought disorder. That's the kind of that doesn't come close to meeting the standards set forth in Brustel. Regarding the fight or flight, I'm sorry, I've got a frog in my throat. The post-conviction court noted that this doesn't come in unless there's foundational evidence that supports it. And the only foundational evidence that could have been provided here would be by the appellant taking the stand and testifying. That would have opened him up to a host of questions about on cross-examination, about his criminal history, about his actions that day, et cetera, as the post-conviction court determined, there's no basis to believe that a reasonable attorney would have done this. And the fact that trial counsel here didn't follow that was not ineffective assistance. The alternate perpetrator claim, that's just trial strategy. It's up to the trial counsel to determine which potential issues, which exculpatory evidence is going to be pursued. To prevail on this, appellant needs to show what further evidence would have uncovered. and then be able to show that it would have had a reasonable probability that it would have affected the verdict. And under the Hawkins test, you have to come forward with evidence that has an inherent test tendency to connect your alternate perpetrator to the crime. He throws out, you know, the sons just because they were in the house next door. I don't think that's enough. The other person, he's not even there. The evidence that we have shows that he was in his car at the time. If he couldn't have been there, he couldn't have committed the crime. Now, could further investigation have uncovered evidence that he was lying, that he was in fact there? It could have, but that's pure speculation and a conclusory allegation at this point. And the
is it not unusual for the district court, and is it not unusual in a post-conviction proceeding for the district court to entertain and base its decision on evidence presented by the state before or without an evidentiary hearing?
Well, when you are examining whether the facts alleged in the petition warrant relief, the post-conviction court is entitled to look at the entire record. That includes all the trial testimony, all the record that was presented in the trial. So I think the post-conviction court can look at all of that and look at all the evidence that was presented and weigh it against any of these allegations. But there's nothing.
Isn't that something that's usually done with argument and at an evidentiary hearing or not? As opposed to before an evidentiary hearing and not allowing an evidentiary hearing.
Well, if you're going to rule without an evidentiary hearing, you'd have to assume the facts alleged in the petition are true. And assume the facts alleged in the petition are true. They just don't meet the Hawkins standard for allowing alternative perpetrator evidence to be presented. If it doesn't meet that standard and it would be inadmissible at a trial, then there's no way that it could have affected the verdict and the post-conviction court properly denied relief without a hearing on that issue. There needed to be something more than what was in the facts alleged in the petition.
So counsel, just to be clear, because I didn't ask the appellant's counsel this, but did the state, when we talk about the argument of whether the district court can consider the evidence presented by the state, I mean, did the state present evidence in response to post-conviction motion, or was just looking at the trial evidence in ruling on whether the petition warranted a hearing?
I'm going to apologize. I don't think I can answer that question. I haven't reviewed the state's response in the last couple of days.
Okay, I'll just make a note. I want to hear about that on rebuttal. What particular evidence is it post, not including the trial, that the objection is to relying on from the state? Okay, go ahead.
But at the end of the day, looking at the allegations in the petition, I don't think they warranted a hearing and they didn't warrant relief. The other claims about Telemania and the other.
To be clear, even though you lack a basis to answer Judge Smith's question, do you concede that it would not be proper for the district court to consider evidence that was not presented at trial if the court is going to decide the petition without an evidentiary hearing?
The wheels are turning on that, Your Honor. It's evident if it was submitted as an exhibit in the post-conviction hearing, if it was received in the post-conviction hearing as part of the state's response, I would submit that that is in the record and could be considered by the court. I agree that the post-conviction court should not make any credibility determinations before a hearing. But I'm just looking at the petition as put forward by the
But if the district court is receiving evidence that's not previously in the record at the stage of the pre-evidentiary hearing, when would the appellant ever be able to present a challenge to the evidence that the state relies on in response to a petition?
Oh, if they had responsive evidence, I think they could provide it. But
and isn't that what an evidentiary hearing is for? I guess that's what and I guess your wheels were turning at the same time mine as well.
An evidentiary hearing is to make credibility determinations. If there aren't any credibility determinations,
well, and
to
weigh
be
the
made.
Evidence and weigh the evidence too. It's not just to make credibility determinations, but part of that is weighing the evidence.
Well, let's say that there was evidence presented in the post-conviction court improperly addressed it. Are there grounds for granting relief? I don't believe there are. Just looking at the petition and the allegations of the that surround the alleged alternative perpetrators, there's nothing that shows that that meets the Hawkins test. I just lost the Carbo case last year, where the Supreme Court talked about the evidence there that tied the alternative perpetrator. And that's a far more evidence than we have here. Yes, does the one person have a potential motive? He maybe had a motive, but he's miles away. Did either of these sons have a motive? No, they were nearby, but what motive do we have? What any indication showing that they would want to physically harm their biological mother? There's just nothing that has an inherent tendency to tie these people to the crime. If you can't meet the Hawkins test, then you're not entitled to relief. And I'd ask the court to ask counsel on rebuttal, what do you believe is the evidence that inherently ties any of these people to the crime?
Can you address the sentencing argument? I'm trying to, get a clearer sense on the basis for the state's position that there was a sufficient aggravating factor.
The multiple stab wounds is what the court relied on. I think that is consistent with case law. The district court could sentence on that, find that the multiple stab wounds by itself warranted the upward departure. I think the top of the box was 439 months. He got 480 months. So a 41-month upward departure. That's about a 10% upward departure. We're not talking about a double upward departure or anything like that.
Well,
we're talking at about
it's not de minimis. I mean, this is time with no liberty, and it's a rather long time if you look at it in the context outside of the if you're looking at it just an objective period of time as opposed to the proportion of the sentence. It seems like it's not insignificant.
Right, it's not, but my point is it's not a double upward departure that other cases have examined. In comparison to other cases, it's not as severe. I know that if we could do it all over again, a different question would have been posed to the jury, and there'd be a stronger basis for the upward departure. Question, is this a sufficient basis for the upward departure? The district court or the post-conviction court found that reviewing the district court sentence, that it was sufficient. And I just asked the court to affirm.
You acknowledge that it's not a compelling circumstance, or not in the guideline sense, but it's not the overwhelming type of aggravating circumstance that we typically see.
I would concede that, yes. If there are other questions, I'll entertain them. Otherwise, I'll cede my remaining time.
It appears not. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And maybe just start out by, I mean, I'm looking at that there appear to be some exhibits perhaps that were submitted by the state, right, in an affidavit. But I'm not exactly sure which ones were relied on by the district court and how they factor into your argument.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. I think I draw the court's attention to the analysis of Matthew Lenhardt as an alternative perpetrator, specifically relating to his alibi, in which the court looks at a statement made by his wife about his whereabouts on the at the time after the murder, when he was traveling to the crime scene. That was a secondary issue we raised in our original pleadings, that based on the time that it appears he arrived at the crime scene, he must have been closer to the crime scene than he told law enforcement. But I wish to correct the state on the issue that he had an alibi for the time of the murder. That is absolutely untrue. He had an alibi for a time about an hour and a half after when they suspect the murder occurred, which was more than enough time for him to drive home, be in his vehicle in the driveway, and doing this alleged medical call that was never corroborated. But the court specifically looked at some 360, phone 360 information that was provided to law enforcement in reports that was not part of the trial record, in reconciling where his whereabouts after the murder, and whether or not it, in fact, he was there sooner than he should have been. The court completely ignored the issue of him not having an alibi for the time of the murder, the fact that it wasn't explored by trial counsel or by law enforcement, or the suspicious circumstances of the time that we do have record of, that 9:30 time period, which was 9 to 9:30 time period, which was long after the murder. So the court used that evidence more or less to discredit the idea that Matthew Lenhardt was an appropriate alternative perpetrator. And of course, I laid out in our brief significant instances and facts in the record, as well as some outside the record, that indicate that he, in fact, was a viable alternative perpetrator. But the biggest issue here, really, again, when
Let me just pause there for a second, just to be very plain. So, when you're talking about inside the record and outside the record, the way you're using that is the trial record versus information provided post-petition. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And
Okay.
I'm sorry. I don't consider the information submitted by the state that was not in the trial record to be appropriately before the court or considered. And I think the court abuses discretion by considering that because the statute does not allow it in. And I think Judge Ross, you peeled that onion for me a little bit. We didn't have an opportunity to respond to it. We didn't have an opportunity to contradict it or provide information contrary to it. I mean, this information I just provided about the alibi is an instance. We specifically had requested a hearing on this issue and requested an opportunity to respond. The court granted it, and then at the hearing, which was off the record, the court indicated it would be granting our petition, at least with regard to ineffective assistance of counsel. And then we went to scheduling, and the court gave me leave to amend the petition. And then all of a sudden, we received the response that our petition had been denied, which took us aback. I don't know to the extent that the court made those emails part of the court record, but if they're there, I'd ask the court to take a look at it. But yes, the statutes don't permit the state to introduce contrary evidence, and doing so would contradict the statute's presumptions in favor of the facts established in the petition and viewing them in the light most favorable to the petition. It involved, and we see it throughout the court's order, where the court weighed evidence and made factual determinations after doing so, when it weighed evidence submitted by the state versus evidence submitted by appellant. And that is not appropriate. That is what an evidentiary hearing is for. And so when we're talking about the abuse of discretion standard, we see it throughout the court's order where it did those things. For example, it presumes and assumes that trial counsel's actions were appropriate, which I don't think the presumption that trial counsel acted appropriately is in effect at the time of the petition, because again, that's not viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the petition. But it assumes things like trial counsel had all the evidence and reviewed all the evidence that the state submitted in contravention of our position. I don't think the court can make those assumptions on a petition for post-conviction relief. It assumed that the trial counsel had considered the alternative perpetrator. It assumed that trial counsel would have been aware of these text messages the day before the murder, where defendant says, "Hey, I found this bent knife in the garage, feet from the murder scene where the victim was murdered with a knife."
In
It
your
assumes that.
waning seconds, can you quickly summarize or address the sentencing issue? It occupied so much of your time during your principal argument, you didn't get to it.
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Judge. Yeah, I think that's probably a very strong and very clear issue, to be frank with your honor. We simply do not have the Blakely factors matter. We don't have a Blakely the conclusions of the jury do not satisfy Blakely the way it was used. And I would just note as a parting issue, I think the state's comments on the length of the sentence has no place in this analysis. It could have been one day, it could have been 1 hour. If it exceeded the guidelines, the analysis is the same as whether it was 10 years. We didn't bring an objection to it being cruel and unusual where that analysis may have applied. So.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you, counsel. Thank both of you for your briefing and for your arguments today. Very helpful to the court. We appreciate it. The matter is submitted and we'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thank you.
Thank you.